Thank you. My name is John Troche. I'm an alcoholic. Pleasure to be back here again. Tonight we're going to be talking about steps 8 and 9, which is, like I said last week, there were two steps that I saw on the wall, on the shade, that I knew I would never be able to do, and those were 5 and 9. Just that was never going to happen for me. And there's a lot of fear and anxiety in relationship to this idea of getting in front of somebody and actually admitting that I was wrong. That went against everything in my nature, just shouted against that prospect. And doing the work up until this point has prepared me to actually do that. You know, that's really, this is not something that we should ever just jump into doing. My experience with these two steps were I needed a lot of help. I needed a lot of preparation. I needed to be clear about what I was doing. I needed to be organized. I needed to have a relationship with my higher power, who I call God, and a relationship with my sponsor, because I needed some real-world practical advice about how to approach certain people and how to do certain things. And my experience has been with amends is that no matter how terrified I was in the beginning, it has been revealed to me how unbelievably important these two steps are. I mean, there's so much healing involved in steps 8 and 9. It's unreal. One of the things I find really fascinating, like I love to hear in an AA meeting or an AA talk when people talk about amends stories. You know, like that's some amazing stuff. And so tonight, most of the time, I'm going to be just giving you amends stories and telling you about, you know, my various experiences with these two steps, what it was like. If you want to follow along on page 76, you know, after we've just completed step 7, it says, now we need more action, without which we find faith without works is dead, which is a reoccurring theme throughout this book, this faith without works is dead idea. Now, I'm not a biblical scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but I am aware of the fact that that line, faith without works, comes from the Bible, the book of James. And this idea that, you know, faith is vital, faith is really important, but it really doesn't do much if you're not going to actually have a practical application of that faith, if you're not going to go out and actually do something with it. He says, let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. That's the 8th step prayer. If I don't have the willingness to make an amends, that's okay. Ask for it. Pray for the willingness to make the amends. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. Where I came from with my home group and sobriety and recovery, there was a guy who was an old-timer in my group. His name was Roy. And at one point, Roy was my grand sponsor. But when I first had come into AA, Roy was the guy, and this was, you know, this is back in the 90s. So he was, I think he was like, at that point he had like 18 years or 20 years. Now he's over 40 years. But he was a member of like some kind of club, I think, like a speaker's club, where like every month he would get like the speaker of the month. And every month, Roy was always passing around different tapes from different conferences of different speakers. And this is back, like, there was actually cassettes we were listening to. Like, this is, you know, back in the day. Even, you know, CDs existed, but, you know, speakers really, typically at that point, weren't on CDs. So we would get tapes. And we would hear all these people, from Joe and Charlie, to Don Pritz, to Joe Hawk, to Mark Houston, Scott Redmond, all these Earl Hightower, all these speakers that I, you know, over the years I've gotten to actually meet and talk to, and it's been amazing. But back then they were just like these, you know, these voices, you know, like that I didn't even know what they looked like. And I would listen to these speakers and these amazing stories, and it had such a profound effect on my recovery and how my sobriety was going to go, because I heard things that, you know, that were just like I wasn't actually hearing in all these other meetings that I was going to. And so that's why I think it's a great thing, like what you guys do, you know, recording these talks and posting them on your website. I mean, for me at least, it was an important part of my early days getting sober. And there was, you know, this one guy, well, there's a group of guys that came out of Colorado, and they talked a lot about a way of doing steps 8 and 9 that was very organized. And they talked about how they were directed to take index cards. And they would take index cards, and basically what happened was, you know, you would transcribe from your fourth step the people that you owed amends to, and you'd write their name and you'd write any contact information that you had about them. Now, remember, again, this is, you know, pre-Facebook and all this other stuff where it's much easier now to get that info. But back then, it was like, you know, whatever I had written on some scraps of paper somewhere, it might not even be a correct address, but something, and you'd write everything that you could put onto that card in relationship to that person. The other thing that was important to put on that card was the exact nature of the harm. What was it that I actually did? Because I wanted to be clear about what I was actually going to somebody with. One of the directions that I got, I got sober with a lot of really mean, cruel old timers who really, they were not nice people. And they would say things like, you know, if you're going to go make amends, don't waste their time. You've wasted enough people's time. Like, you better be clear about what you're going to talk to them. All right, I got it. All right, I'm a bad guy. All right. So, you know, we would know exactly what it was, what the conversation's going to be about. And another thing that came out of this group of people was this idea of there were certain things that were pertinent to be discussed in an amends, right? Like, I wasn't exactly going there to say I'm sorry, because I've been saying I'm sorry my whole life, but I was there to say that I was wrong. I was there to tell them what I was clear about in my wrongs. But one of the really important questions that it was like one of the earliest things that was hammered into me that I was to do, I was to ask this question. And the question was, after I had finished explaining how I was wrong, right, was, is there anything I missed? Is there anything I left out? Is there anything you want to tell me about what I'm telling you? Or is there anything that you want to tell me that I didn't even mention? And that was very interesting, because what I came to find out about this whole amends process is I have a whole set of stuff in my head about how I think I harmed you. And that doesn't necessarily match up with what you think I did at all, really, you know. And to have that situation where people would bring up things and say things to me that I'd never even thought of was pretty shocking, you know. That was pretty shocking to find out, I never even considered that. I never even considered that that would be something that would harm somebody, that somebody would carry that for years with them. And that became very... you know, a very teachable moment for me. You know, I think I know how I harm people, and I really don't have any idea. And that's why it's important for me to ask these questions. So this was the basis of the beginnings of the steps 8 and 9 for me on getting organized, getting prepared to be willing to make these amends. And then the other direction that was important was I would take these cards and I would put them into 3 categories. I put them in willing to make amends, kind of on the fence about making amends, and never going to make amends, right? And they would go into those 3 categories, and what I would do was I would start with the people I was willing to make amends with, because I'm already there, right? I'm ready to go. And I would start to get momentum by making those amends. Every time I would make an amends, I would take that card out of this little envelope, and I would put it into this other envelope called approached or completed. Right, and basically, my object was to get all of those cards from those 3 envelopes to that one last envelope. And it was like such an organized way to do it, because, you know, I'm not organized at all. And I'm, you know, I think it's almost like a defense mechanism for the alcoholic to be so confused about things, because it's like plausible deniability, you know, like, oh, I forgot about that. I do that a lot. So this was a way for me to really be on top of it, in a way that I never could have been on my own. And so those all came as the directions from speaker tapes that I'd heard, guys that had been doing it that way for a while, sponsorship. You never underestimate the value of good sponsorship. It's like key. probably most of the problems in AA could be solved with just good sponsorship. You know, and it's so important that we get connected with people that we can ask questions and be like, well, why do we do it this way? Why do I even have to do these stupid steps, you know? And have somebody that can really sit us down one-on-one and we can feel comfortable with, you know, going through that whole dialogue. So probably there are still some misgivings, yeah. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we've hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. And this is a key line right here. At the moment, we're trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Now that is an amazing line. I do not come into AA believing that at all. That's not my main purpose. My main purpose is to get what I want when I want it, as often as I can. That has been my main purpose my whole life. And they're talking about, as the result of working these steps and getting involved in a spiritual practice and trying to maintain and grow a spiritual condition, that we are getting to this place where we start to see that the real purpose in life is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And so I think about, what does that mean to fit myself? You know, because there's been times in my life where I was a bit like a huge gym rat. I love, you know, I was in the gym every day and it was really important to me. So like I think about if you were gonna run a marathon, right? If I was going to try and run a marathon today, it ain't happening. I'm not doing it. I'm going to be, you know, dead within a few miles. But if I actually wanted to run a marathon, what I would do is I would train. And I would, there's a specific training that I would go through over a specific period of time so that the day that the marathon was going to be run, I could run it and complete it. And that would be fitting myself to run a marathon. What I'm looking to do here is to fit myself to be of maximum service. So, to God and the people about me. So, when it comes up, I'm fit. I can do it. You know, like when you turn around and you say, hey, can you help me with this? That spiritual fitness is already, like, it's in place. And yeah, of course I can help you. Can you go out of your way to do this thing for me? Yeah, okay, I can do that. And so that was like, that one word in that sentence, fit myself, is like the key. Doesn't mean every single day it's always going to be on maximum service. You know, sometimes being of maximum service to God and the people about me is just me sitting down and just listening to you, you know. Sometimes it's really not that big of a deal, you know, but just to be able to sit down and listen to somebody sometimes for me in my life was a huge chore. Now not so much, but back in the day, absolutely. Let's move forward to page 78. Because this is like one of the biggies for us. It says, actually, before I go to 78, I actually do have one that's important to hit on. And it's the man that we hate. Let's see. Here we go. Page 77. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him. And though we have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It's harder to go to an enemy than a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. So here's a tough one. This step does not say we made amends to the people that we were willing to make amends to. Right? Or it doesn't say, you know, we make amends to the people that we like. Right? It says to all. Right? Whether we like them or we don't like them. Whether, you know, whether we feel they did something to us or not. So one of my major experiences with this was with a guy who was the general manager in this company that I worked at, you know. He was operations manager, and we didn't get along. You know, like he saw things one way, and I saw things another. Right now, in real time, when this was happening in this period of my life, the way I saw it was like, well, he's just a jackass. You know what I mean? Like, he's just an idiot. This guy is like, he's got it out for me. And so, like, it was one of these things where we started out okay, but as time went by, we just kept knocking heads and knocking heads and knocking heads to the point where there was just so much animosity. And in my mind, it was like, this fucking guy, you know, I just wish he would die. I just wish he would drop dead. I hate this motherfucker. I mean, I just couldn't stand this guy. And, like, I remember one day, and it's an amazing kind of thing where we were having an argument about something, and we were in the back of the building, and there's a dumpster back there, and he was up by this door by on top of the stairs, and I was down by the dumpster, and we're screaming at each other back and forth. And I don't even remember what he said, but he said something, and I just, like, I literally jumped in the air, and I karate kicked the dumpster. And I said, fuck you, come on, let's do it now. And this is, like, this guy is, like, my manager, and I want to fight him. You know what I mean? Like, I want to beat the hell out of this. Let's do it. And I'm, like, I want to, like, kill. And, like, what the hell is wrong with me? You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like an insane lunatic. So, but it was like all of this stuff with this guy. It was always something, and I just didn't like him, you know? I hated him. I hated this guy. And so, you know, I would read this line, and there were a lot of people that I made amends to that I didn't like, but this was the one guy that, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not doing it. I'm just not going to do it, you know, because he really did, in my mind, he really did more to me than I did to him, you know? And so every time I'm at a meeting or every time I'm working with a sponsee and I get to that one line, he comes right to my head. Fuck. That guy. The one guy. The one guy that I'm never going to do it. I'm never going to do it. And so it was probably, you know, it was a few years back. I remember I'm going through the steps again and I get to this line and he comes up again. And I have to look at it and be like, it's telling me I have to take the bit in my teeth. Because no matter what I thought he did to me, I was such a bad employee. You know what I mean? Like, I really was. Like, when I really took a look at, like, how I behaved and what I did on the job, yeah, of course he had problems with me. Like, it was so, I spent so much energy trying to make it look like I was working that if I would have actually used that much energy to work, I would have been a superstar. You know what I mean? But I didn't. And so, initially what happened was, when I came back into AA and I began to go through the steps, there was the changing of how I behaved at that job. Because I was there for a few years beyond coming into AA. And we still had beef, but it kind of simmered down. But I never actually made the direct amends to him. The behavior changed. And I got to be a better worker, for sure. But there was always that air that wasn't cleared between the two of us. And so finally when I got to this place again and I saw this and I knew I had to make those amends, I go, fine, you know what? I'll do it. I'll do it. And I show up. I had to make amends to someone else at that company too. And I'll never forget, I show up and he sees me and he goes, oh, you looking for a job? I'm like, oh, no, I'm not looking for a job. But I do want to talk to you. And he goes, oh, like this, you know, like, here it comes, whatever it's going to be, it's not going to be good, you know. And I'm just like, I'm just praying, like, God, please don't let me say something stupid, you know. And we go out to the back and we just start having a conversation, you know. And I start to, listen, you know what, like, I have to make amends. And I go through the whole thing. I go through how I behaved as an employee, how I acted, how I treated him, how I disrespected him. I didn't respect him as a manager. He would tell me to do things, like whether it was through a text message, an email, face-to-face, over the phone. He'd tell me to do things, and I would pretend like, oh, is that what you meant? I misunderstood that completely, you know? And I would just do what I wanted to do. And I went through all of that stuff with him, you know? And the amazing thing was, we have this conversation, and he turns around and he says, you know what? I wasn't the best either. And I'm like, jeez, you know, like, I wasn't expecting that. And it says, if you read down further, he says, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him we'll never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. we're there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. And that was the thing, the real sticking point I was trying to stay with. I don't want to get into what he did. All I want to do is talk about what I did. And he says, if our manner is calm, frank, and open, we'll be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we're calling upon admits his own fault, and there it was. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. And it was like that. It was just like, you know, he admitted, like, yeah, you know what, like, I was, you know, back then I was unreasonable and blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't one of these amends where it was like the fireworks and everything else. It was like I walked away with that thing of like, I am willing to do whatever it is I need to do, even make amends to the one guy I never want to make amends to because I think he's a jackass. You know, and I'm going to do it without causing more harm. Right? I'm not going to go there and tell him about, well, you know, I did this because you did that. And it was just a great experience. And I remember the thing that I had mentioned to him, you know, one of the important points was if you ever come across anybody who needs help, you know, if you ever come across anybody that has a problem with alcohol or any of the other substances, feel free to give them my name and number. You know, and just to be able to leave it like that, shake hands, I mean, it was even though it was a minor amends in a sense, it was a big amends, you know. And so it leads us to this next part. It says, on 78, most alcoholics owe money. Now, my group, you know, we are, like I've been telling you for the last few weeks, we are like a big book study group, and we go through this book. It's just we go line by line. And years ago, we used to have this old-timer named Curtis. And there's certain things that always stick for me. They always stick in my head. And whenever we would get to this line, Curtis would always say, if there's one thing that should be changed in this book, most alcoholics owe money? No alcohol. All alcoholics owe money. You know, he would say that every time, and it was like tattooed in my brain. Like, yeah, like all of us, we owe money, you know? I owed money. And so when I started going through this process and really taking a look at what I owed people, it was daunting, right? Because I owed a lot of money. And there were things that I had conveniently forgotten over the years that I didn't even think about that I owed money for. And so I'm going to give you a couple of examples. The first one that I had conveniently forgotten for a long time was in 1991, I robbed a McDonald's. And I just forgot about it. I don't know how you forget about something like that, but I had forgotten it. It was an armed robbery. I'm not like some tough guy or anything like that. And it's really a stupid story, and I'm going to tell you it. But it's one of those things where I had been through these steps a lot of times. And not one time, and I was thorough. And not one time did that ever enter my mind. I just forgot about it. It wasn't even like I was like pretending like it didn't happen. I just didn't even think about it. And then one time I'm going through these steps, and I get to 8 and 9, and all of a sudden I have this memory. And the memory is there's me and we're at a party, and we leave the party, and we're driving around, and we're hungry. You know, we want to get something to eat. And we come to the McDonald's, but none of us have money, you know? And I go, well, let's rob it. You know, let's rob the McDonald's. And they say the one thing to me you should never say to me. And they go, you're not going to rob the McDonald's, right? And I go, oh, yeah? I'll rob the McDonald's. And they go, right, whatever. I go, okay, there's a side door, and I want you to pull the car over to the side door and just wait. And I'll be out. And they go, okay, let's see this. So now I'm drunk, and I walk into this McDonald's, and there happens to be this guy that I went to school with, you know, behind the counter. And I go, and it's late. And I go, what do you got? He goes, you know, we're not making anything fresh, but we have. I go, can you wrap that, all of it, put it in a bag. And I'm just telling them everything, that, put it in, great. It's like 3-4 big bags of food. And after he finishes putting it all together and he puts it on the counter, and he looks at me and I go, my buddy, he has the money. He's going to be in here in like about 2 minutes. He goes, okay, cool. So he goes back to, you know, I don't know, picking his nose or whatever he's doing. And he's over on the corner and I'm just watching him. And I'm watching him, and I have the bag, and I'm watching him. And as soon as I feel like he's not paying any attention at all, I grab the bags, and I run out the side door. When I run out the side door, though, the car is not anywhere to be found. And I go, I'm like, what? And then all of a sudden I see them, like, on the other side of the parking lot, like, flashing their lights. So I'm running with these these McDonald's bags. And they're like, the police are in the parking lot right over there. So I dive in, and we speed off, and it's great, and it's the greatest ever. And now we're eating because, you know, we were hungry and we were drunk, and now we're happy, you know. And I had forgotten all about that until I'd gotten to this 8 and 9 step again. And I go, oh my God, like, how do I make amends for that, you know? Like, that, it had been so long since that had happened that McDonald's had actually moved across the street. Like, they literally, they demolished the building and they made a new building across the street. So I go, I guess I have to go there, you know? So I go to this McDonald's and I go, can I speak to a manager? So the manager comes out, and I go, I don't know how to tell you this, but when this McDonald's used to be across the street back in like 1991, like I kind of like took a bunch of food without paying for it. Like I robbed it. And she's just looking at me, right? And I go, and what I want to do is I want to pay the money back. And she goes, wait, what are you talking about? She goes, what? She goes, when did this happen? And I was like, I think it was 1991. I'm pretty sure it was 1991. She goes, yeah, I can't take your money. And I go, is there like somebody higher than you that I can speak to? And she goes, you can talk to the owner, but he's not here. So I go, can I get his number? Yeah, sure, I'll give you his number. So she gives me his card, and I leave, and I call my sponsor, and I go, you know, this girl stared at me like I had three heads. It was like so, like, it was just really bizarre. You know, it's a weird thing. I get it. I know it sounds bizarre, like, you know, some dude coming up to your McDonald's talking about how he stole from another McDonald's across the street years ago, and now I want to pay you back. Like, what the hell is that? So, like, I'm on the phone with you know, I'm talking to my sponsor about it, and I get home, and I go, okay, let me call up the owner. And now I call up the owner, and we have this conversation. And again, it's this awkward, bizarre conversation where I'm going, I know this is going to sound really weird, but this is what I'm trying to do. And I explain the whole story to him, and he goes, after I'm done, he goes, listen, I've never heard of anybody doing anything like this, first of all, so that's cool. He goes, but I got to be honest with you, like, that McDonald's, when it was across the street, I didn't own it back then. That was somebody totally different. So even if I wanted to take the money, I can't take it from you. So, but thanks. I appreciate it. I get, you know, that's a nice gesture and to have a good life and whatever. So now I'm sitting in my living room and I'm like, this is so stupid. You know, like, what am I doing? So I'm sitting there and I call my sponsor back and I go, I guess I got away with one, right? Like, what do I do with this? And he goes, well, you know what? Like, I think maybe you should pray on it and see what comes up. And I go, all right, you know. And I really feel like this is a total waste of time. I feel good that I actually, you know, like, I had the whatever it took to go and do this thing that I knew was going to be embarrassing, which it was. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm praying. And I'm going, how do I make this right? And all of a sudden, I get this, like, this inspiration. And I realized that McDonald's has the Ronald McDonald House, right? I go, holy shit, the Ronald McDonald House. So I get my computer and I go on there, and sure enough, really easy, I can just make a donation to the Ronald McDonald House. And I go, this is great. And I give him the credit card, I send the money, and I'm done. And it's awesome. And then, like, the only problem with this one story, though, is, like, ever since that happened now, Ronald McDonald House will not stop hounding me for more money. Like, they keep emailing me all the time for more, and I'm like, all right, I guess I deserve that. But other than that, I mean, it was just like this cool thing. It's like, we think, like, how can we make things right? You know what I mean? Like even like a stupid thing like that from something I did years ago. And I had a lot of those where there was stuff that I did from years ago that I never thought about, and all of a sudden one day I said, "Oh, wow. That community, that townhouse community that I basically, you know, vandalized and spray painted things about Satan and stuff on." I mean, just crazy nonsense like that kids do. And I'd never thought about it. And like, well, how do I go and make that right? You know? Do you try going to a condo community, you know, 20 years later, telling them about the graffiti you did and how you want to make it right? They don't get it. They're like, "What are you? Why are you doing this?" You know. But you know, see, the thing about AA that's cool is like I have a buddy who he does like real estate management, you know. And so like I call him up and I go, "So listen, here's the deal, and this is what I'm trying to do. If somebody had this deal with a place that you run, like what would be the proper channel? Who would I talk to? How would I get that money to those people? What would I do?" And he was able to go, "Well, this is exactly what you got to do." And he told me, "Call this person, talk to that person, email this person." And it was just like, see, that's like what we do for each other. You know, these steps, 8 and 9, like, you have like a wealth of information at your fingertips. You just have to be able to ask people. That's the beautiful thing about the amends experiences. Like, people have experiences doing all these different types of amends. Some of them really deep and hard, and some of them, you know, silly, you know, like the McDonald's one. So most alcoholics owe money. We don't dodge our creditors. Tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. You know what? Here's one last financial one. My buddy James. He was like one of my best friends in AA years ago. And at one point in my life, I hit some hard times and I needed some cash to pay my rent and some other things. And my buddy James always, you know, he was always good with money. He always had cash. And he let me borrow a few hundred dollars. And with the understanding, I'm going to pay you right back. And so as soon as, you know, he lent me the money and right from the beginning, I started paying him back, you know, a little bit at a time. And then kind of this thing happened where, like, he wasn't really asking for the money, and I was, like, really not giving him the money because, like, I had more important things to spend the money on. So it kind of, like, it wasn't, like, it kind of petered off. Like, I started to, but I never finished paying him. And then, you know, a little down the road, we kind of had a rocky stretch, and then we just stopped talking over something completely unrelated. And then years went by, and years went by, and years went by. And then, you know, right around the same time with the McDonald's and everything else, he comes up in my head, too. I'm really, like, this was a point in my life where I wanted to hit, like these financial amends. Because I was, you know, there was a part of me that did not want to pay the money back at all. And I remember, you know what? James. I never finished paying James back. So I started looking for James on Facebook. And James was like the one person not on Facebook, right? If you could believe it, he was just not there. And there was no sniff of James anywhere. Like, I had no idea what happened to this guy. And periodically, so this was probably a few years before the McDonald's that I was trying to contact James. And periodically, I'd look for him, and I couldn't find him. And then finally, one day, out of the blue, I'm on Facebook, and who do I see? James. And I'm like, "Oh my God, pay dirt. This is awesome." So I send him a message. And I tell him, "Listen, you know what? I still owe you money. And I want to pay you the money back. And what do I do? Let's talk. Can we have a conversation?" And James writes me back and he goes, "Yeah, you know what? We'll talk at some point." You know, like real kind of dismissive. And I'm like, I'm trying to give this guy money. Like, what the hell? You know? So I go, "All right, whatever." And then I let it lay for a little while. And then I write him back again, you know, like a little while later. Like, "Hey, listen, you know, like, let's talk because I'd love to get you this money." And he doesn't even say anything. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what's wrong with this guy? Right? Mm-hmm. You guys remember what year was Superstorm Sandy? What year was that? 13? 12? Whenever, whatever that year was. right? Superstorm Sandy is headed towards us, right? And all of a sudden, you know who calls me? James. And you know what James wants? He wants his money. He wants his money, and he wants to see if I can meet. He had moved to Connecticut, and he wanted to see if I could, if there was somehow I could meet up with him, like now, to get him this money. And I'm like, dude, you know there's like a hurricane coming, like a bat, like you know that, right? He's like, yeah, but I need it. And like, there's this part of me, like when we're having this conversation, like part of me wants to be like, dude, what the hell is, you know what? You've always been an idiot, you know? Like, this is probably why we're not friends anymore, because you're just a moron. You know, like, there was a part of me that wanted to say that. I didn't say that. I did not say those things. But there was a part of me that wanted to say that. And I go, okay, well, let's think about what we can do. How can I get you this money? And his first suggestion was that I meet him halfway between, I live in the Bronx and he lives in Connecticut, that we could meet halfway. And I'm like, yeah, dude, there's trees coming down. I don't think we're going to make that happen. And so we brainstormed for a while, and finally we figure out a way that I think maybe at that point, what is it called? Apple Pay or Chase Pay or one of those pays were like brand new. Like I wasn't that familiar with it, but it was like a new thing. And I was able to get him his money, and he got it. You know, and it was just like one of those things where it's like, I had to remember in that situation when this guy is asking for his money and I'm thinking, like, what an idiot, is, well, I've had his money since 1998, you know? Like, that's his money. It's been his money since 1998 that I never paid back. You know, so, like, if he wants his money now, like, I probably shouldn't be annoyed that he wants it. I should just make sure I can get it to him in whatever way I can. Right, so there are all these different ways that I owe money and things come up. And I want to say, like, you know, my personal experience has been I'd like to make excuses for why I can't pay the money back right now. Right? Like, I would like to be like, well, I do want to pay you the money back. I do. But like, right now is not optimal for me. Because I have a lot of things going on right now, but later on when I have a lot more money, I will definitely pay you everything back all at once, and you can have it. And that, like, I kind of want to do that thing. And what I learned about this program is that steps 8 and 9, all of these steps, but 8 and 9 in particular, they're all connected in a very strange way. Like, I, you know, like sometimes I feel like the everything is just unconnected or unrelated. Like, I don't even know why we're doing all this stuff, because what does this have to do with me not drinking again? Like, what the hell? You know, what's the point? Why am I even? It's like a useless exercise I'm going to do. Okay, I'll feel great for about 2 seconds that I paid you your money back. Whatever, but it's not really that important. But what I began to find out as I did this was that it was very important to not just me staying clean and sober, but the quality of my recovery and my sobriety has been amazing. And I started to see that, like, things happen in the world that sometimes they would seem unrelated, but I started to see that in the world of the spirit, like, all things are connected. So what I mean by that is I would have experiences like, I owe you money, and I don't really want to pay you the money back, but I go, I got to pay this money back. And I have excuses for why I shouldn't pay you back right now, because, like, at this one point, I bought a new car, bought a house, and we were planning a wedding. I had a lot of financial obligations, you know, like, now's not great. But I knew that that was just BS based on my experience, and I knew I had to start paying, even if it was in, you know, pieces, you know, installment plans, that I had to start paying it back. And this is the weird thing that I saw in almost, not every single one of my financial amends, but most of them. And I'm not saying this happens for everybody. I'm just saying this was my experience, and I saw this. I would pay money back, and this weird thing would happen where, like, money would pop up somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know, like, I know it sounds stupid. Like, that doesn't even make any sense, and it's just a coincidence. I know it sounds that way. But it would happen so often that I would start to go, like, this is really weird. Like, I paid this person money, and all of a sudden money just shoots up over here from this other seemingly unrelated source. And usually it was even, like, a little bit more money than what I just paid out. And I was like, that's so weird. And so I'm paying money, and then money appears, and I pay money, and money appears. And then I'm pretty sure, like right now, like what I do, like my career right now is a direct result of making amends. You know, like I probably never would have been, like, had the opportunities that happened in my life if it hadn't been for the fact that I was making restitution, and like things would pop up, and I got these opportunities that maybe I never would have gotten had I not been doing what I was doing. And so that's just been my experience. And the cool thing about this particular thing is you get to find out for yourself if that can happen for you or not. And I would venture to guess there's some people in this room that have had experiences like this that can say, yeah, I've had my own version of that happen. And it's just a weird thing. I've sponsored guys that I'm not making financial amends. I had this one guy, you know how they send you credit cards? Well, they sent the credit card to the wrong guy. Like, lots of credit cards. Like, this guy is, like, the worst guy to ever send anything to. And he would take the credit card, and he'd go right to the bar, and he'd buy everybody drinks all night, and he'd have a huge party, and with no intention of ever paying it back. Because, hey, they're the idiots that gave me a card. So he had thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that he owed creditors. And they were looking for him for years. And this guy, he had to set up his life in such a way that when he got paid, instead of having a bank account, he'd have to give the check to his mother, who would put it in her bank account. And then whenever he needed money, it was like this whole thing, a whole situation he had to arrange his life around, because if he had any kind of account, they'd come and take the money. So we get to steps 8 and 9, and we're talking about making restitution, and we talk about that. And he goes, I'm not paying them back. I was like, all right, why not? He goes, because they were stupid enough to give me the credit card. I don't owe them anything. And I said, so you don't see how you owe them their money? No, they're a corporation. They don't need it. Like, okay, all right, I guess. I said, but, I mean, I'll just tell you this, and this is just my experience, and this is how I try to talk to people when I work with them. It's like, all right, maybe that's true, maybe it's not true. I can only tell you my experience and what I've seen. And my experience is, if I'm unwilling to make the amends, there's a good chance I'm probably going to drink and get high. I mean, that's just probably what's going to happen, because it's what's happened in the past. You know, so, I don't know, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but I would venture to say that if you're not going to make those amends, you're probably not going to get too much further. And he said, yeah, but I'm not going to do that. You know, I'm just not doing that. I'm like, all right. You know, and, you know, he stayed sober for a couple more weeks, you know, but he just was not going to do that. I mean, it was just there was no way he was ever in his mind at that point that he would ever do that. You know, now I'm not saying that that's the only reason why he relapsed, because there's, you know, probably other reasons too. But I'll tell you what, that the resistance to doing what needs to be done is a big part of the reason why most of us go backwards. And so they talk in here a little bit about shame, guilt, and remorse. You know, like the way we treat people, the things that we do. Now, if I think that I can treat you like garbage, cheat on you, lie to you, mistreat you, abuse you, all the things that I do when I'm out there, if I think that I can live like that, right, and that those feelings aren't going to fester, I'm crazy. It's like a cancer. It just sits, you know. There are people that can do it, for sure. They're called serial killers, right? They can do that. They can harm people, and it just like seems not to really bother them much at all. They almost enjoy it, you know. And so, if maybe you're a serial killer, and if you are, then you know, go in peace. don't talk to me after the meeting. But for all the rest of you that are not serial killers, like, you know, we have consciences. You know, like I have a conscience. Like there were things that I did in my life I genuinely felt bad about. I carried that with me. You know, I thought that I could pour enough drugs and alcohol and that stuff to just forget it forever. But you know what? Couldn't. It always seemed to pop up in some way, shape, or form in my life. Shame, guilt, and remorse. So those unresolved feelings, it's like an accumulation of those things. They just keep on building up and building up and building up. We talk about in this book, they talk about blockage, being blocked from that which sustains my life, that which is giving me sanity, that which is empowering me. When I get blocked off from that power and I'm back at that place where I'm powerless, I have no choice but to drink. That's just the way, that's just the equation. That's the way it goes for us. So these steps, I mean, all of these steps are important, but 8 and 9, it's crucial stuff because there's debris, right? The wreckage of my past that has accumulated and it's there. And I think like last week I was talking about in 6 and 7, you know, the landfill that's inside my head and in my emotions, you know, it's just landfill. You're just garbage on top of garbage on top of garbage. And now's the time to clean that stuff out. Clean it out so that I can have some, you know, I don't want intermittent juice, intermittent power. I want like even flow. I want to have that flow in my life 24/7. We have my home group, our name is Pathway to Power. We had our 7th year anniversary yesterday. And you know, the ironic thing about it is we almost didn't have our 7-year anniversary because we lost power. Like, isn't that funny? Like we lost, like, literally, we lost power. You know, that stupid storm that came through? Well, it, like, wreaked havoc on that neighborhood. And, like, the night before on Friday, one of our group members sends out a group text, guys, we might not be able to have this party, you know? And we had, like, workshops all day planned, and food, and speaker, and dance, and the whole thing. And it's like, it's a metaphor for what we have going on here. See, like here's like the world's greatest alcoholics in my home group. We all like put our minds together and we come up with this amazing plan of like, this is going to be killer. These workshops are going to just destroy everybody. And our speaker is amazing because she is. And the party and the DJ. I mean, the whole thing. We have a plan. We have a plan. And yet, what happens when we lose power? Guess what? The plan's out the window. Yeah. It's done. It's a wrap. We're like this. We're like, oh my God. Like, it's literally, there's nothing we can do. Or we were dependent on Con Ed. Luckily, we knew somebody in Con Ed that could pull some strings for us. But basically, we're depending on Con Ed. And so in a real way, like in this deal that we have going on, like I'm looking for spiritual Con Ed, you know? Like, let's go. I need to get connection. It can't be intermittent. I need the juice flowing in every day. And we take it for granted when we have it all the time, you know? We take it for granted. But this is what has been my experience in AA, practicing these principles. When I do this thing, man, it's just like there is no problem. The power takes care of that. I'm cool, man. My life is awesome. I am a blessed person, and nothing has to change for me to go from that to the guy that goes, this sucks, this is awful. You know what I mean? Like, nothing out there really has to change. It's just the way I see the world. Right, this process is going to help me change the way I see the world. Making amends is going to help me change the way I see the world. Now, I'm going to you to make amends to clear up and have some healing for you, if that's possible. That may not be possible. You may never want to talk to me again. And if that's the case, then so be it. But I'm going there, I'm trying to get some healing for you, but also for me. This is a part of my recovery process. Let's see. They talk about, you know, cheating. I talked a lot about that a couple weeks ago. Here's a line that's a killer on page 82. He says, the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer who came out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" I mean, being the alcoholic who's like a tornado, that was one of those things. In early days, that really resonated with me, being the tornado, like seeing that. There was like an incident I remember where... me and my younger sister are home alone, and we're fighting over probably the phone or something stupid. And I'm like in the middle of like, I'm choking her or something. And in the middle of the process, my oldest brother opens the front door, and he sees like basically me like choking her. And then he just like comes barreling up the stairs and I go zipping down the hallway into my room. I live in a house at that point where none of the doors work anymore because we busted all the doors are broken. So you can't just shut and lock a door. So I run into my room, I shut the door and I barricade myself against it. And he comes just bombing right through the top, right over me. The top of the door just goes, folds right over and he goes over me. So then I run back out and I narrowly escape and I go and I'm out. And I leave for, I don't know, a day or two. I'm gone. And I'll never forget. I come back home after I'd been gone for however long I was gone. And he had, and I had posters all over. I mean, I was like the coolest kid ever, you know, like all the posters and the whole deal. And he ripped everything down and destroyed it. And I remember the rage. Oh, my God, this motherfucker. I mean... Holy crap. And so I'm an artist. I got paint. So I go and I get the paint. And I write on my bare walls. There's a song by The Doors called The End. And it says, there's a part where he goes, he went into the room where his sister lived, and then he paid a visit to his brother, and then he walked on down the hall, and then he, and basically I'm like, here's my murder note to all of you and my family. You are going to die. And I'm writing it in giant letters on my wall. And then on my destroyed door, I write, you know, F you, but you know, the real word, in giant letters for everybody. Here's my message to you. I think like shortly after that, I ended up in like some unit somewhere. And when I came back from that little stint, I remember being in my room and just looking at those in big black letters up on the wall. It was like in black and white, the rage and anger and turmoil that's going on in like my insane head and my heart, my sickened heart. And it was like just clear as day, like there's something wrong with me. You know, there's just something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. I don't know what is wrong with me. But that's what I am. I'm this alcoholic who's like a tornado. I roar through people's lives. I just don't give a shit. It's about what I'm going to get. I don't care what you need or what you want. I need and I want. I need to get what I want. I don't give a shit about your whatever your expectations. Don't bother me with that stuff. See, that's like my attitude. I go into everything with just leave me alone. Just leave me alone. And that's how I act, and that's the whole thing that I do. So I make amends to my oldest brother years later, and I remember this was one of the ones that really kind of hit home for me. He moved down to Virginia Beach years ago, and I'm at his home down there, and we're next to this little pond, and you know we're doing the conversation, and I get to that part where I go, "Is there anything that I left out that you want to let me know?" And he goes, "You know what? Yeah, I'll tell you something." He says, you know, what you don't know is that I had to have that conversation with Mom about you where I told her that she should give up on you the way I gave up on you and that it was only a matter of time before we were going to get that phone call in the middle of the night that you were dead. And I hear that and I'm just like, it's like a punch to the face, you know? It's just like, I mean, I guess maybe I could have imagined maybe things like that would happen. But like when you actually hear it and it's confirmed, it was like one of those things like, you know, it was as bad as I remember it being. You know, like the way I acted in my family with anybody that was around me, it was like I'm not one of these people that can hide my sickness real well. If I'm misery loves company, if I'm not doing well, you know it. You know, and back then it was just blow, wind, blow. That's all day, blow, wind, blow. Constantly agitated, irritable, restless, discontent, you know, the whole deal. And so I saw that stuff. And, you know, it's almost like the financial amends are almost way easier than those amends. You know, when you think about it, like when you think about the fact that, hey, I owe you money and it's pretty clear that's what this is about and I'm going to just pay you back the money and then I pay you back the money and then we're done. And that's cool. I love that. But what about the people that are close to me? You know, because here's the fear that I had with amends. Is like, I'm going to make this amends, but you know what? I'm still going to act like an asshole. You know what I mean? Like, what do you do about that? You know, like, I'm going to go to you and I'm going to make amends, and then tomorrow act the same way? How? How does that make me look even dumber? You know? And so I start to see in this whole process, every step along the way, I need this power which I call God. I need it. I don't have the power to act any way other than how I act. I'd like to act like a child of God. I'd like to act like I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. I'd like to treat you the way that, you know, you said in nursery school, you know, the golden rule, and treat others as you'd have them treat you and all that. I'd love to do that stuff. But it's like I'm incapable, you know, on my own power. So I'm making amends, and 6 and 7 is a crucial part of this whole deal. I don't want to be the person I was anymore. You know, I have seen what is objectionable, and I don't want to behave that way anymore. Am I a saint? Hell no. But it says right here, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And that's what I had to do. I had to live the spiritual life. I had to try and access this power on a daily basis. And how the amends look for family members is some of them are easier than others. Some of them wanted to forgive me right away, and it was, you know, let's put it behind us and let's move forward. And others, not so much. That sister that I was choking, yeah, it took a long time for her and I to get right. So I had said the words, I had done the amends, but it's not about, oh yeah, you said some words to me, whoop-de-woo-woo, you know? Let's see how you act. Let's see what kind of person you are. And that took a long time. There's real healing that is to be had in AA. It says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we're sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but chances are our own actions are partly responsible. And that's the deal. You know, I'm not saying that other people don't make mistakes. Obviously, people do wrong all the time. I'm not saying that my family members didn't have problems. Sure they did. But this isn't about their problems. It's about me. And how do I act? And how do I behave? And it's just unbelievable the damage that we do with our family members. So the last one I want to talk about, because I'm kind of running out of time over here, is my amends with my father. Because that one was pretty significant for me. My father went to prison when I was 9. My father was, you know, he was a guy who grew up in Brooklyn. By the time he was 17, had his first kid. By the time he was 20, had 3 kids. Right? The only way he really knew how to make a living is, you know, the criminal way. He's what you would call an associate. Right? And, you know, he's a pretty bright guy. And he did a lot of really underhanded stuff. There is a 9-year gap between me and my older sister. And you know why? Because he was in prison for those 9 years, you know? And then when I was 9, he was going back to prison. And when I was 9, he went back to prison. He got 20 years. And I remember how resentful I was about that, because this is bullshit. You know, I'm going to lose my father, right, for 20 years. He's not going to get out of prison until I'm 29. It's bullshit. Yeah, you mean to tell me I'm not going to get to have the stuff that fathers get to teach their kids? I'm not going to have any of that stuff. Oh, and by the way, you know, he was an earner. That dude was an earner. And I had no idea how good we had it until he went away. And then things drastically changed for us financially. Sucked. So there was a lot of resentment in connection with Dad. He's a douche, he's this, he's that, he's the other thing. And I just had so much anger towards him. He wasn't a nice guy. He wasn't. And somewhere in the, late 90s, whenever it was, I was on a relapse, and I had, in the middle of the night, driving drunk, I had basically gotten to a fender bender, a high-speed fender bender on the FDR, late at night. And it was all my fault, 100%. And the guy, he hit me, but it was my fault, and he ripped out my back, my whole back of my car was gone. And I remember I stopped for about 2 seconds, and I said to myself, if I stay here and the cops come, I am screwed. I mean, I'm just like, I have no business behind the wheel. And I just fled. And I'm like doing like, I mean, I'm like zipping around Spanish Harlem. I'm like cutting through streets. I know they're following me somehow. I'm trying to lose them. And I get home. And I wake up the next day and I look at my car and I'm just like, I'm incensed. You know, I'm just like, I can't believe this happened. And my father calls me up from prison and he goes, you know, we're talking. I tell him what, you know, I don't tell him the whole story, but I tell him that, you know, I really messed up my car bad and I don't have the money to get it fixed. And we're talking about it and he goes, do you want me to send you the money? And I go, dude, you don't have that kind of money. He goes, actually, I have some money saved up. If you want it, I can send it to you. Do you want me to send it to you? And I go, you have, he goes, yeah, like, listen, you can pay me back later on down the road, whatever, but I'll send it to you. And I go, okay, yeah. I mean, as soon as he said, you know, the thing about paying him back, like that, like went in one ear and out the other, like that part I didn't really listen to. It's like, you want to give me that money? Okay, great. So he sends me the money. And I immediately forget about how I'm ever going to pay that back to him. And I'm not going to pay him back. I'm not. And so dad gets out of prison in 2000, somewhere in there. And he gets out, and now he's trying to get his life together, you know? And one day he gives me a call, and he goes, hey, listen, son, you know, remember that money I lent you, like, you know, a few years back? I have this thing, I'm trying to put together something, and, you know, do you think maybe I can? And I go, I just remember my reaction. I was, like, so indignant. I'm like, are you kidding me? I don't have that money. And like in my mind, I'm like, how dare this guy even ask me for this money back? I mean, like, it's the least he could have did is just let me have this money. You're just such an idiot. You know, in my head now, I'm like, you. And so basically, he drops it. And never to bring it up again, which is exactly my intention. That's what I wanted. Don't ever bring that up again, Dad, because you're not getting that money. And so I'm going through the steps again, and I get to 8 and 9. And I remember, oh, I never paid him that money back. Mm-hmm. And I go, and I start having that thing in my head, like, well, you know, do I really have to pay that money back? I'm, really? And it was just like, you know, talking to the sponsor and prayer. Yeah, I got to pay it back. So dad, in the meantime, over the years, he'd gotten sick. He got Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was, now he's at the point, you know, this is years later, fast forward, he has Parkinson's and he's sick and now he's like in assisted living. He needs it because he can't take care of himself. And so I go to him and he's still not that bad yet. You know, he's still kind of in the beginning of it, but, you know, he has it. And I go to him and we're talking and I have this conversation with him and I go, Dad, do you remember when you let me borrow that money and I never paid it back? And we have that whole thing. And he goes, listen, you don't have to pay me back. I go, no. I go, I have to pay you back. I have to pay you back. I go, I can't pay it all back right now, but I'm going to pay you in installments. This is how I'm going to do it. And he goes, all right, well, listen, if you're going to pay me back, don't send it to me, though. Send it to your sister. Because, you know, he's still, to the very end, you know, like a shady character.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want anybody to know he has any money. So he's like, do it that way. Or fine, Dad. Okay, I'll do it that way. And he goes, I'm proud of you. You know, like, that's a really stand-up thing. And he tells me about an experience that he had similar to that with his father. And it was, like, a really cool experience, you know. And, like, I felt free. And I felt like, you know what? I felt pretty good. And so what happened was in 2016, my dad is dying. You know, he's dying, and we know it. And he's in the assisted living, and they call us and they tell us like it's, you know, he's gonna go any day now. And we show up and we're there, and I'm sitting there, and in the room as he's dying, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just like, I'm thinking. And I go, did I do enough? You know, like, I've really, like, there's this, anybody who's ever been in that situation, you know, like, this thing start running through your mind about, you know, did I do enough, and how did it happen, and, you know, you replay things in your mind, and I'm sitting there, and I'm wondering, and this is the end. And, you know, because the thing was, here's the thing about this, is, like, I had this thing in my head that, you know what, when my dad gets out of prison, when I'm 29 years old, things are going to be different, and we're going to have this amazing relationship, and we're going to get close, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And that's just not the way it happened. And we never got to have the kind of relationship that I would have wanted to have with my father. You know, we just didn't. It's just the way it was. And so, like, I'm questioning, like, well, you know, I didn't have that relationship, so did I do it right? And so I start thinking about, you know, like, when he got out of prison, you know, I was there with my brothers and sisters to come pick him up, you know. And when he got diagnosed with Parkinson's, like, I was there. And when, you know, we had to move him from his apartment to my sister's house, I was there. And when we had to move him from my sister's house to the, you know, assisted living, I was there, you know. And, like, now he's dying, he's in his deathbed, and I'm there. You know, and like, I gotta tell you, man, my whole life I was a no show, no call. You know, like, I don't want to fucking deal with that stuff. I don't want to deal with anything like that. I just don't do that. And then I just saw, like, see, this thing that we do, it's like I'm able to, like, be present, be there, do the thing that I could never do. Not because I can do it, because I've been empowered. Because I got access to some power. And so I'm there, and, like, that's becoming clear to me. And, like, I know, like the amends is complete, and Dad, go in peace, and I love you, and all that stuff is behind us, you know. And he goes. Now, here's the thing about it, is now me, I have two brothers and two sisters. And we're, you know, circled around, and we're talking about, okay, now what are we going to do about his arrangements and blah, 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 blah. So we start talking about it, and kind of like the feeling was we just split it up, you know, between us and be done with it. And before we even start getting into that conversation, my sister goes, forget it, we don't even have to do that. And, well, why? And she goes, he's got that money. He's got that money in his account. Don't worry about it. And that's weird. Like, what? Why would he have money? He didn't have any money. Like, what are you talking about? So I pull her over to the side, and I go, Lorraine, I go, the money that you're talking about that he has, is that the money that I was sending you for him? And she goes, yeah, that is. That's the money you were sending, like, every month for, like, 2 years or wherever it was. You know, it just never got spent. It just built up, you know, and she saved it for him. And it was just like one of those moments where, like, I just realized I saw the way this whole thing is connected. You know, like, that thing that says to me, that voice that says, you don't have to pay that money back. Fuck, screw that. You know, like, I saw, like, there it is right there. And it was almost like one of those God shots where, like, God goes, see, you know, just do what you got to do, man. You don't have to understand how the story ends. Just go through with it. And it's going to be revealed as time goes on. Don't worry about it. And I saw it, and I just, like, it was one of those things for me where, like, you know, when my dad went, I just had a lot of peace with that, you know. Like, there was a lot of all those unresolved feelings and all that stuff was able to be dissipated, you know. And it's directly because of the work that's done in Steps 8 and 9. So anyway, you know, I had other stories too that I want to talk about, but I just, you know, I go into rabbit holes. So you got what you got, and there you go. Thank you.